party awaiting Walter at the horizon study, using the kind of language that makes the sergeant blush. Oh, wasn't join the army, that's what we all inquire. Don't we pity the poor civilian sitting around the fire? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pain.
As soon as Reveille is gone,
we feel just as heavy as lead.
But we never get up to the sergeant brings a breakfast up to bed. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh,
what do we want with eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam? Home for the right turn, how do we spend the money we earn? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pay.
As soon as the valley is gone,
we feel just as heavy as lead.
But we never get up to the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
What?
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
What do we want with eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam? Home for us, great car, we spend the money we earn. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Come to the cookhouse door, boys, sniff at the lovely stew. Oh, as it says, the colonel gets better grub than you. Any complaints this morning? Do we complain, not we? What's the matter with lumps of onion floating around your tea? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pain.
As soon as Reveille has gone, we feel just as heavy as lead. But we never get up to the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
Rats.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, wasn't wanting eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam. Home for the right turn, how do we spend the money we earn? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pay.
As soon as Reveille has gone, we feel just as heavy as lead. But we never get up till the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
Liar.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
A lovely war.
With eggs and ham, when we got
welcome to part two of Cambridge and the Great War, How the City Survived. In the first programme, we heard about how Cambridge men enlisted to fight and why some, conscientious objectors, chose not to. We also looked at how the roles of women changed during the First World War and how views on morality also began to shift. In this programme, we'll talk about what happened to the men once they reached the battlefront, how they stayed in touch with loved ones back home, and what kind of life they returned to in Cambridge once the war was over. Local residents, historians and historical experts will help us unpick the facts from the myths and paint a picture of what it was like to live in this city during that period.
Private folks in the funny little codger with a smile, a funny smile. 5 feet none, he's an awful little dodger with a smile, a sunny smile. Flushed or broke, he'll have his little joke. He can't be suppressed. All the other fellows have to grin when he gets rid of his chest.
Hey!
Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you blow the but to light your fag, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. Ooh, pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. Private Cook went a-marching into Flanders with his smile, his sunny smile. He was loved by the private and commanders for his smile, his sunny smile. When the throng of Germans came along with a mighty swing, Herbst yelled out, "This little bunch is mine. Keep your heads down, boys, and sing." Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you've a loop that was so light, you're a fag. Smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. Oh, pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you balloon that was so light, you're a fag. Smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. Oh, pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
It's estimated that between 1914 and 1918, more than 6,000 men from Cambridge and its suburbs went to fight. That's about a quarter of the male population living in the area at the time. Whether they signed up willingly, keen to do their bit to defeat the Hun, as the Germans were known, or whether they were conscripted, they would have known a little about what was waiting for them at the front. Local historian Mike Petty explains.
Obviously, our lads left and they fought in various places, including the Dardanelles, and we knew what they were suffering. It's no good to say we didn't know what they were going through. We did. Because certainly in the villages surrounding Cambridge, they wrote letters back to their mum. And their mums put the letters in the local papers. So that as you turn the pages of the weekly paper, you don't want to get to page 7. Because page 7 is where you'll see the photographs of the people that have fallen. Page 7 is where you've got the long list of the men of Cambridgeshire who's died in the latest fighting. And there also are the letters. Letters that say that they were about to leave and they were shot by a German bullet. And that German bullet went clean through a book I had in my pocket and some letters and worked its way into my chest. And the soldier sends back to his mum the postcard his mum had sent to him. And wouldn't you wish you'd written him a 20-page letter? Or bought him one of these Chemico shields that you could buy from the local shops? We did know. We may not have known all the great detail, but we were reading accounts of sufferings and accounts of trenches. It was coming back day by day into the homes of people whose sons had gone, whose fathers have gone, or those with families who are fighting to make sure that their sons or fathers don't have to go.
We'll hear more about those postcards later. And while it may have been true that those at home knew about the conditions in Belgium and France, it didn't necessarily mean that those going out to fight were as practically prepared as they should have been. Arthur Marshall was in the 1st Battalion Suffolk Regiment in 1914, fighting alongside General Gordon in Khartoum. His grandson, Henry Marshall, takes up the story.
So he was out there when the First World War broke out. And so the British Expeditionary Force went into France, but he went out, they were shipped back via Malta, back to Britain at the end of 1914. They arrived in December 1914 in Liverpool from Egypt. I imagine they felt the cold a bit. And they then were sent down to, well, they ended up at Winchester, as the 1st Battalion Suffolk Regiment, where they were equipped for going out to France. Not very well equipped, I understand, because they started marching down from Winchester down to Southampton, and then they disembarked on the other in France, and by the time they were marching halfway across France, their boots disintegrated.
Janet Slade's father, Walter, was with a Midlands regiment, but though he was at the front line, he wasn't a soldier, and he told Janet about an unusual companion he had while he was there.
He was a map maker in the trenches, and because, you know, all the the things that you navigate by, a lot of them had been blown up or knocked down or were obliterated by smoke or fog, and he had to make maps for the troops, and that was his job in his regiment. They were down in these trenches with sort of mud, and he actually had a bed, because I remember him saying that was the place that I had to work on with my maps. And the other thing he said, there were rats down there, and when we finally got into bed and covered us with whatever we could, something climbed onto the bed at the end, and it was a rat. So I kicked it off, and it came back again, and I kicked it off, and it came back again. He said, in the end, I gave up, and for several nights, the rat came back and kept my feet warm. I took no notice of it. I thought, if he can stand it, so can I.
Not all animals on the battlefield had such a cosy time. Heavy guns, weapons and supplies, as well as injured and dying men, were mainly pulled or transported by horses. In 1914, the British Army had 25,000 horses, but the War Office needed more. 500,000 more.
Horses were an important part of the war need, and they needed more horses, and the military needed horses. And Cambridge horse dealers were going around the local villages trying to ensure that farmers would give up their horses for the military. And of course the farmers are saying, no, we need our horses to plough the fields and to enable us to grow crops. This also gives spell where Cambridge horse dealers are appearing in court, because the farmer claims that the horse dealer said he was buying horses from the military and could only pay one price, whereas in fact that man was buying for himself and selling on to the military at a profit.
Henry was a man who, I know, was destined to be associated with horses for much of his life. He was a groom to several well-known families, and he had his own business in the end. He was a cab owner when he went to war. And my father remembers Henry sitting up all night nursing his horses and just seeing that they were hopefully fit to go to work the next day. Henry survived the war with his horses, and it must have really upset him, because there were thousands and thousands of horses who were killed and in such desperate situations that for somebody that loved them as much as he did, it must have been an added pain.
I remember that the tragic photographs of horses in ditches that couldn't be buried, and they were just sort of bloated and their legs stuck up like table legs. This awful. And I was, why are they lying upside down? I was only six or five. And then I turned the page, and there was another page with photographs of a big field going up a hill. And there were little tiny beds all the way up in rows and rows and rows and rows and rows. Little tiny beds. And then there was another page with more beds on a different field, rows and rows and rows of them. So I went and said to my mother, what are all these beds doing on the fields? And she said, oh, that was before a big push. What's a big push? When they had to have an assault on the enemy. And I said, but what are the beds there for? She said, well, all the men would get wounded because of the bombs and the machine guns and the firing. And all those beds would be filled by evening with wounded men.
Mike Petty there, followed by Michael Bowyer, talking about his grandfather Henry, and Janet Slade remembering the profound effect that photographs of the battlefield had on her. Hundreds of thousands of horses died during World War I, alongside approximately 800,000 men.
Good evening, people. What a game. Now the Kaiser full of sausage, red Napoleon it be, then went and broke his promise, it was made in Germany. He shook hands with Britannia, and eternal peace he swore. The naughty boy, he spoke at peace while he prepared for war. He stirred a little Servia, the Servia's dirty trick. But dirty knights at Liège quite upset this dirty dick. His luggage labelled England, his programme nicely set. Shoved at first stop Paris, but he hasn't got there yet. It was Belgium put the kibosh on the Kaiser. Europe broke the cane and made him sore. And on his throne it hurts to sit, and when John Bull starts to hit, he may never sit upon it anymore. It was Belgium put the kibosh on the Kaiser. Europe dropped the cane and made him sore. And now he's lamed it in the woods. We won't buy his German goods, and we'll never taste his lager anymore. Stick to the British whiskey you're used to. The great fellow, the Kaiser, he and his German culture. He went to get a little bit of British physical culture. That'll do him now. What about General von Kluck? Kluck, kluck, kluck. He's no chicken. He'll never cluck again. The French have broken his right wing. I was speaking to an Irish friend of mine the other day, one of the Dublin Fusiliers, over home here, just with a shot through the arm. He said, I'll be back again in a fortnight, sir. I said, well, how are you getting on with the Germans? Ours, says he, they're like a lot of rabbits in a warren. They're digs if you can't find them. But one of our young lieutenants of a humorous turn of mind got them out the other day. He walked right up to the German French and he shouted, waiters! And there were 208 popped up and we shot a lot of them. Now, gentlemen, as you were. The Kaiser ought to go to school and learn his geography. He quite forgot our colonies and our hands across the sea. He'll find we hold 4 acres that will beat his game at nap. Why, he didn't notice England, just a small upon the map. While Patsy's are defensive, said the Kaiser, I'll be John. He didn't know the Irish, though he may do later on. And though the Kaiser made the war, excuse him for the crime. His lunatic attendants were not with him at the time. Belgium put the kibosh on the Kaiser. Europe dropped the cane and made him sore. And we'll soon shout out with joy, hold your hand out, naughty boy. You must never play at soldiers anymore. Belgium put the kibosh on the Kaiser. Europe dropped the cane and made him sore. And we'll make the German fame play the tune we understand. Rule Britannia rules the waves forevermore. That's the British one.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, March 1914. A postcard was received by Mr. North of Sussex Street, Cambridge, on Sunday from his nephew, Corporal Agger, who is at the front with the British Expeditionary Force. He wrote, "Arrived in France quite safely at Boulogne this afternoon. It was a grand passage. Sea quite calm. Cold and windy at night. People very good. Cannot understand language, but many of the officers speak French. Weather very hot. Plenty of warships in the channel. We are sleeping in a cut cornfield tonight. Hope you are all quite well at home. Kind regards to all. Cannot get much news as to how the big battle is going. Everybody is wearing the red, white and blue ribbon." Corporal Agger is well known in Cambridge as a footballer. He played several matches with the United last Christmas. Mr. North is sending him a Cambridgeshire Chronicle every week, as he is anxious to know how things are going in England.
Postcards were indeed a vital way of staying in touch. Roger Lilly has an extensive collection of postcards from this period.
You've got the sweetest little way. I like to watch you all the day.
Today I haven't received anything yet. I'm pretty sure that you write to me every day, but I am imagining that you may be ill. You cannot know what is happening because it is so far. Never mind. Have courage, my dear friend. Margaret is feeling a lot better. Everybody is well, and we wish that you are the same. I kiss you 1,000 times, my good man. Your wife, who loves you and does not forget you.
So, here we are, well settled down. We've put up some showers, and I had one today. Soap everywhere. It feels very good. You probably have news from me now. For myself, I haven't yet received anything. We had a dress inspection today, and one for the horses. Every Saturday, it's the same thing. I just bought a few cards from a seller that was passing, and I'm sending some right away. My health is still good.
Always so happy to receive your news. Today I'm still digging the potatoes and feel such sadness that I have to cry. I worry about you. Everyone is well. I wish you were even better. 1,000 good kisses. Your wife, who only lives for you.
On the other hand, I mean, there are some occasions when you get very graphic insights. We've got a postcard of a French woman writing to her husband who's reporting on the death of someone they know, a young man, who was killed by a bullet while he was playing a game, jumping up and down in the trenches.
We have just learned the sad news that Cousin George has been killed. He was in the trenches with Cousin William, and they were messing about, jumping up and down. The Boches saw his head, and a bullet shattered his skull. My heart has been bleeding since. His father already lost his wife, and now he has lost this boy into whom he poured all his love. And this damned war had to take away what was dearest to him. Why so much suffering? When will it end? Courage, my friend, from your wife, who does not forget you for 1 minute.
You have an image here of young men at the front, bored out of their minds, doing stupid things, basically, in order for to pass the time, and being shot in the process. They're an incredibly powerful way of personalising, you know, the whole experience of a terrible thing like the war, to actually hold the letters and the postcards which, you know, people would have handled. And you just have to put yourself in the shoes of, you know, that someone at either end, either at the front or back home, receiving a postcard and knowing that the person who wrote it was still alive, they were still thinking about them. And I think that's why it's so much more interesting to collect the used postcards, ones that have actually been sent, than the ones which, when you turn over, are just completely blank and have just been collected.
I have a card which went to the front in Flanders and coming back again and survives today, and I'm looking at it, and it's from my father to his father, and it says, "My dear Daddy, just a card to wish you a very happy birthday. With fondest love, your ever-loving son, Freeman." And that takes the breath away from me, because this has been to the war, it's come back, and it's in remarkably good condition. It's a card that thousands send in their millions, probably. And on the reverse of the place where you can put the message, it says, "For King and Country, thinking of my dear soldier." And I won't read through all the details, but it is quite a throat sticker, because it really does take you back to that time which is suspended in animation during a war. The atmosphere is so different, and people are so different. And if you've experienced it, and not many people perhaps have today, in the extremes that affected the country in the First and Second World Wars, these little messages to a man soaking wet, sat in his trench with mud up to his knees, his heavy coat, great coat, soaked with water coming through, and nothing that he could wear was going to stop him from getting more and more wet, and his feet were probably in terrible condition, and he could hardly walk, and you suddenly get out of the blue a moving card like that. It takes you away from the horror of the noise, the terrible noise. War has a noise in the front lines which people try and show in films, but it's nothing like the reality of it. It's so total. You cannot think straight, you cannot hear straight, you can't hardly hear straight. And these people were subjected to this day after day after day. And those little cards, those little messages, the Queen sent tin boxes with sickies and chocolate in them, and a little card. Fantastic public relations, absolutely fantastic.
Well, we have postcards from him fairly shortly afterwards saying, "I've been sent to this place for another operation. I'm now back in Southampton for recuperation. And the mayor of Southampton has come to visit me, and I don't think I'm going to have any more operations." And then another postcard saying, "Oh dear, no, they think I'm going to have another operation." Which must be quite horrific, because at that time there were no anaesthesia machines. People were still using ether largely for anaesthesia, to achieve anaesthesia. And so it was not very well controlled, all a bit risky. But jolly painful process.
Over 1.5 million British soldiers were wounded during World War I. Many were treated on the battlefield or in military hospitals in France, and a significant number also returned to the UK for treatment and recuperation, some specifically to Cambridge.
There is, of course, another side of Cambridge which is very important, and that's not just the training of men to fight. It's the repair of the men that have fought. Because Cambridge was designated as one of the great military hospitals for the First World War. That too had been planned long before. But when the war starts, you know there are going to be casualties, and casualties need to be cared for. And Cambridge is the base of the first Eastern General Hospital. Now, that is based for a while at the Lees School and also at Trinity College, because Trinity College has its great, has its library, and the library is suspended above the on pillars, and underneath the arches at Trinity College, beds are put, and wounded, mangled men come back to Cambridge on the hospital trains that steam into Cambridge Station, and their members of the Red Cross are collecting them and taking them to Trinity, where the doctors and nurses are trying to deal with them. But all too soon it's the start of term, and anyway that space isn't sufficient. So they put into action the plans that have been laid for a massive military hospital that stretched from Queen's Road to Grange Road, right across that area where now Clare College Memorial Court and the University Library stands. Row after row of wooden huts open at one side, and soldiers arrive. One reason that that little lane that leads from Queen's Road through to Grange Road, Burrell's Walk, is so wide is it was needed to be made wide to take the ambulances, the horse-drawn ambulances, which were bringing so many men into that hospital. And in that hospital, then they were given the best of modern treatment. We were pioneering bath wards, and there are photographs of it. One of the things that we did in the Cambridgeshire collection in the 1970s, when we were sorting through the photographs that were taken by Palmer Clark in Post Office Terrace, we came across a pile of photographs that showed the troops in those military beds in the First Eastern General. And there they are laying on the beds and being treated, and you can look beyond the men and there are the bedside cabinets, and the bedside cabinet is open and you can see what the soldier has got in his... And of course, once these men are nursed back to fighting fitness, then they're sent back to fight again and to be wounded again. Some of the very first troops who left Cambridge at the start of 1914, saying it will be all over by Christmas, were back at Christmas, wounded. And of course, it's not just the First Eastern General Hospital. There are the VAD hospitals, the Voluntary Aid Detachment, where the soldiers are being nursed after they've left. And there were a number of those, including several in Cambridge and in the surrounding villages, and one of the villages was Histon.
And as Deborah Tom from Robinson College, Cambridge, reminds us, these hospitals were largely staffed by women.
You get women, of course, being nurses during the war. Cambridge has a lot of hospitals, and it has new sorts of nursing. The local MP was called Almeric Paget, and he set up something that was actually called after him, Sir Almeric Paget's Massage Corps. And the new science of what we now call physiotherapy starts really with these young women, mostly quite educated young women, learning about how the body works and doing massage. And then there's the famous Great Eastern Hospital out where now the University Library is, with lots of nurses working in the open air. And there are other hospitals where many of the nurses are actually men, because they're dealing with soldiers with unpleasant diseases.
Her tales of people who had been wounded and their incredible courage, knowing that they wouldn't get better. And she said, gave me a story about two of them who said, well, if you last through till the morning, you owe me 10 fags, 10 woodbine. And the other one said, oh, and I'll beat you. I'll last till the morning. You won't last till the morning. She said, these two kept the whole ward rocking with laughter the whole time. And when one died in the night, the other one said, the bastard, now I can't have my woodbines. he did it first. You know, it was just that sort of thing that she said they'd got such power of keeping up their spirits. Wonderful.
Janet Slade there, remembering her mother's experiences of nursing. Some injured men brought home needed limbs amputating, some had been severely wounded by shrapnel, and some were still suffering the effects of mustard gas attacks. Mustard gas, or sulphur mustard, as it was also known, was first used by the German army in 1917. Though it caused relatively few fatalities, its effects could be severe and long-lasting.
My father had four brothers. One survived absolutely scot-free.
From the war?
From the war, the 1914-18.
So had he been in the trenches, this brother?
I don't know, because he was called Victor the Twister, and he was really rather a sharp card compared to the others. And the other three were in the trenches, and they all eventually died from the effect of mustard gas. Three of them. My father didn't. He died of diabetes in his old age.
Well, of course, the effects of gas is very much a Cambridge story, because Cambridge has chemical laboratories which have assisted in the manufacture of gas. And Cambridge has laboratories which are also assisting in ways of ensuring that the gas can be dealt with. It's part of so much work is going on within the university in so many areas of war. The engineering laboratory, the scientific instrument companies, out behind Shire Hall in McGrath Avenue, the roller skating rink is taken over as of in order to manufacture materials and instruments that are needed by war. Cambridge is really leading the way in this regard. And local companies, many local companies, are producing things for war. And not just the local manufacturing industries, but local firms like the bus company, the Ortona Bus Company, which is finding its vehicles are being requisitioned and taken overseas to ferry people to and from the front. So whenever you're looking at these devices, there's so often there's a Cambridge connection in there somewhere. Which is why when the First War is over and we are planning for a second, that Cambridge scientists are saying never again must we use the university's expertise to kill people. And you get this resistance to militarism that is going to happen again in 39.
The heart of the silver dew.
And when the men did come home, despite the obvious physical and mental legacy of their time fighting, it was common amongst those who returned not to talk about it.
You can't talk about those experiences. They couldn't talk about those experiences. I did chat to one old soldier in who was at Ely, and he was saying that it was part of his job. He went up with a mule cart to the front, and his job was to take ammunition up to the front. And as he did so, he had to go across a spot, a crossroads, where shells were falling regularly. The Germans were just sending a shell onto that spot. And he said, I stood there and I counted and I timed. And when I worked out just how often they were coming, then when the time came, I got that mule to gallop as fast as it could go to get over that. And he said, I then unloaded the ammunition and I had to come back. And I had to come back past that same spot where the shells were falling. And this time I couldn't gallop, because in the cart, instead of ammunition, I had bodies. Bodies that were piled high. I could not gallop. He said, I could be home on leave. A week or so later, I could be home on leave. I could be walking down the streets of the village and somebody say, how are you getting on, Bert? And he said, you couldn't tell them that. They wouldn't want to know that. And it's things that these people have carried to them by themselves.
And more than that, they didn't dwell on the past. It was my brother and sister who went out to see the graves, you know, at the, what's the big gate in Belgium, where they have the last, you know, the last, the valley and the last trumpet every night. I forget where, but they both went out to the graveyards. I haven't been yet. I may go yet. There was one other very poignant picture in our house, very big picture, about sort of 2 foot by 18, and there was a very grey-green ruin standing up in the middle, just a broken wall, this high broken wall, sharp one side and broken the other, and rubble at the front of the picture. I couldn't think why. This was a picture in my house because my father was a watercolourist and he did pictures of people and landscapes and doorways and rivers. But this was in the kitchen over the stove, and underneath were the words Ypres, Y-P-R-E-S. And I think my mother, what is that of? There's nothing there. She said, no, there was nothing left of Ypres. And she said, it's almost like having a parallel to the cenotaph in the house, because he remembered his comrades. And there was just this bleak picture. And It was very serious for us children. He'd been there when there was nothing left, and he'd survived.
Survived, but the world that Janet Slade's father and his colleagues returned to was a very different one to that they left. The human landscape of the country and the city was quite different. Brian Harris noticed this as he was growing up in Cambridge.
People with lost limbs, one arm, one leg, no legs. Oh yes, you got quite used to it. And I remember there was one man who rode a bike with one stiff leg. So his left leg was on the pedal, stationary, and his right leg was driving the bike. Oh yes, they were very brave with their injuries.
Henry Marshall reflects on how his grandfather coped with his injury, an injury that resurfaced towards the end of his life.
He lost a leg and lost all the toes except one from his other foot as a result of the shrapnel, and he managed to be mobile and to conduct his business normally. He was a member of the bowling club up on Cherrington Road, Rec, and used to bowl in competitions for them. And he used to sort of stomp around this area here doing his business, and they would go away on holiday as well. So as far as I know, it didn't affect him at all. And when we were boys, the greatest fun was to be put on Grandad's leg and bounced up and down. He used to sing to us and bounce us up and down. So, I don't think the injury was particularly particularly affected his life. Obviously, saw him out of the army, but he had a tin leg, a steel leg with a little clip. So he'd sit down and his leg would be sticking out. He'd press the little buttons and it would drop. So it was like a peg leg. It wasn't like modern prosthetics. But he didn't always wear it. He used a crutch or a walking stick or two walking sticks, depends on how he was at the time. But yeah, we've got photographs of him walking with his stick. But mostly he had his false leg on, his prosthetic leg, and walked about with that. Towards the end of his life, the shrapnel in his remains of the shrapnel that were in his leg, the bomb that he'd lost toes from, started to emerge and become infected, and so he had to have his second leg amputated. So that really did disable him quite badly. Well, very badly, because he was in his 80s.
But those who returned from the battlefront to Cambridge were perhaps luckier than most.
And of course, Cambridge is also helping, setting up institutions to actually try and enable those people to come back and make livings for themselves. We have the war work depots, and wounded soldiers are being taught crafts in that can be sold to help raise money for issues.
But what happened to the women who had found employment and independence in the workplace while the men were away? Deborah Tom.
A lot of people had the idea that now things would go back to normal. But of course, they changed. They changed a lot. People had died. One in eight soldiers dies in the First World War. Two out of every eight comes back wounded physically or psychologically. So there are a lot of households with men who aren't able to earn as much comparatively as they did before the war. A lot of women who have to go on earning a wage. The general sense appears to be that women leave all those hard manual jobs quite willingly. They don't necessarily leave the shops and the offices at all. They often stay there. And a lot of workplaces have more women in them after the war. Cambridge's economy is quite healthy after the war. It expands. So there are not necessarily women keeping jobs that the men want back, but more jobs around for everybody, particularly in areas where women are less controversial. But they do leave a lot of the manual jobs, and a lot of employers want them to leave. They feel happier with male-only workplaces. In other places, you don't get the sense there's much change at all. One of the most remarkable things that happens after the war is in 1919. The college servants, the bedmakers as they're called, unionise briefly, and they go on strike because their wages are so low, and they negotiate for themselves improved conditions. Now, that's partly because of the war, because they've realised how important they are and how valuable, and their wages and conditions do improve. And in 1923, they strike again, and the jam makers in Chivers. So people learn new things in wartime, like to join unions, and that they can negotiate on their own behalf. But a lot of those jobs I talked about before, the post workers, the dairy workers, the railway workers, most of them leave those jobs. Uniform jobs, they tend to leave. And of course, the women's services, we don't have many women in the uniform services in Cambridge, they leave. Nurses, many of them are volunteers, so they tend to stop and go on with ordinary life. And the professional nurses carry on nursing. Nursing becomes more and more a woman's occupation after the First World War.
When the bombs shines bright on Charlie Chaplin. His boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers, they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles. When the moon shines bright on Charlie Chaplin, his boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers, they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles. Someday there will come the time to wind up the watch on the Rhine, and Tommy and Jack will come marching back and take a cup for the sake of auld lang syne. But ere the happy day, the Germans have got to pay. When we march in to capture Berlin, we'll sing them this little lay. When the moon shines bright on Charlie Chaplin, his boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers, they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles. When the moon shines bright on Charlie Chaplin, his boots are cracking for want of blacking, and his little baggy trousers, they want mending before we send him to the Dardanelles.
We hope you've enjoyed these programmes about life in Cambridge during the Great War. Much of this information and more is currently in an exhibition at Rock Road Library.
Brother Bertie went away to do his bit the other day, with a smile on his lips and his left hand and fifth upon his shoulder, bright and gay. As the train moved out, he sang, "Remember me to all the birds." Then he wagged his paw and went away to walk, shouting out these pathetic words: "Goodbye, goodbye, oh, I'm so dear, baby dear, from your eye. Though it's hard to part, I know, I'll be sick of the death to go. Don't cry, don't cry, there's a silver lining in the sky. Bonsoir, all things, cheerio, chin, chin, na, poo, too, glue, goodbye." At the concert down at Kew, some convalescent dressed in blue had to hear Lady Lee, who had turned 83, sing all the old, old songs she knew. Then she made a speech and said, "I look upon you boys with pride, and for what you've done, I'm going to kiss each one." Then they all grabbed their sticks and cried, "Goodbye, goodbye, oh, where's the dear baby dear from your eye? Though it's hard to part, I know, I'll be sick of the death to go. Don't cry, don't cry, there's a silver lining in the sky. Bonsoir, old thing, cheerio, chin, chin, na, boo, toot, loo, goodbye." Little Private Patrick Shaw, he was the prisoner of war, till a Hun with a gun called him Pig Dog for fun, and Paddy punched him on the jaw. Right across the barbed wire fence, the German dropped then, dear, oh dear. All the wire gave way and Paddy yelled, "Hooray!" as he ran for the Dutch frontier. "Goodbye, goodbye, oh, wife, a dear baby dear from your eye. Though it's hard to part, I know, I'll be Nicola Desco, don't cry, don't cry. There's a silver lining in the sky. One for all things, cheerio, chin, chin, snarple, toogaloo, goodbye.
Cambridge and the Great War was written and presented by Lee Chambers. The producer was Neil Whiteside. Featuring contributions from Mike Petty, Deborah Tom and Roger Lilly, with the memories of Janet Slade, Michael Bowyer, Henry Marshall and Brian Harris. Reports from the Cambridgeshire Chronicle were read by Tony Barnfield. The postcards were read by Izzy Rees and James Steadman. This has been a Cambridge 105 production.